Blog Talk Radio.
Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies, a group formed in 2005 for the purpose of creating an active public and policy dialogue on nanotechnology. Nanoparticles are now used in everything from car batteries and appliances to aluminum foil and nonstick cookware. The food and beverage section of Penn even includes various vitamin and mineral supplements that contain nanoparticles, as well as McDonald's hamburger boxes.
Many people believe that nanotechnology may be the next industrial revolution, but is the technology really safe? Just like genetically modified organisms, GMO, nanotechnology has never been proven to be safe for humans or for the environment. Deconstructing and reassembling molecular components and injecting these altered molecules back into our clothing, furniture, cars, and food is really more of a giant experiment in human health than it is in successful technological breakthrough.
A 2004 study found that nanoparticles cause brain damage in fish and other aquatic species exposed to them. And the ETC Group, an international organization devoted to conservation and sustainable advancement, actually called for a moratorium on the production of nanoparticles back in 22. after a European Parliament paper warned about their toxicity.
In 1997, a study put out by Oxford University and Montreal University linked titanium dioxide, zinc oxide, nanoparticles in sunscreen to cause free radical and DNA damage in the skin. And numerous other studies have found that nanoparticles are easily absorbed by cells, where they cause other untold harm within the body.
According to Penn, the majority of nanotechnology applications are in the health and fitness category, which includes the use of nanoscale silver for its antimicrobial properties. Ironically, health authorities have mocked those who use colloidal silver and other similar products for antimicrobial and other health purposes. But now that silver is being used as part of nanotechnology, it is mysteriously becoming widely accepted and showing up in all kinds of products without warning.
In 2008, the National Research Council, one of the national academies in Washington, D.C., stated that none of the nation's 18 government bodies, including the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, have ever proven the safety of nanotechnology prior to its widespread use. Despite $14 billion in government and private investment, there is not one shred of evidence, basic evidence, that shows how nanoparticles are even absorbed and metabolized by the body, and yet they are used in thousands of commercial products that are ingested or applied on skin. See the Penn archive of consumer products that contain nanotechnologies. Visit nanotechproject.org /INVE.
Do you want to take a look at that just to see? Let's just see what that is. it really doesn't have.
Oh, browse product by name, company, or country.
You have to spend more time than we have looking.
I'm just curious if you just hit name.
Browse?
Yeah, browse. By name.
All products A to Z, let's just see.
Okay. Salon dryer, nano ceramic. I don't know what that is.
It's a hair dryer.
Oh. Hot tool.
First Enviro Safely Degreaser.
First Enviro Safety Floor Cleaner. First Enviro Safety Glass and Mirror Cleaner.
FX Cruiser Show. Yamaha Motor Corporation. Stuff by the Nano Silver Straightener. Nano Diamond Ceramic Straightener. These are all made by different. These are personal care products.
They showed pictures of them.
Yeah. All different things. So you can go and look at it for yourself.
Yeah, check it out. It's worth the. Worth checking out.
Worth the effort. Okay. Let's see what else we have here. So that was untested nanoparticles.
Yep. And hit that right there. Yep.
Okay. Tokyo Electric to build U.S. nuclear plants. The no bullshit info on Japan's disastrous nuclear operators. I need to speak to you not as a reporter, but in my former capacity as a lead investigator in several government nuclear plant fraud and racketeering investigations. I don't know the law in Japan, so I can't tell you if Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, can plead insanity to the homicides about to happen. But what will Obama plead? The administration just months ago asked Congress to provide a $4 billion loan guarantee for two new nuclear reactors to be built and operated on the Gulf Coast of Texas by TEPCO and local partners, as if the Gulf hasn't suffered enough. Here are the facts about TEPCO and the industry you haven't heard on CNN.
Never will.
No.
Okay, hang on. The failure of emergency systems at Japan's nuclear plant comes as no surprise to those of us who have worked in the field. Nuclear plants the world over must be certified for what is called SQ, or seismic qualification. That is, the owners swear that all components are designed for maximum conceivable shaking event, be it from an earthquake or an exploding Christmas card from Al-Qaeda. The most inexpensive way to meet your SQ is to lie. The industry does it all the time. The government team I worked with caught them once in 1988 at the Shoreham plant in New York. Correcting the SQ problem at Shoreham would have cost a cool billion. So engineers were told to change the test from passed to failed.
From failed to passed. The company that put in the false safety report, Stone and Weber, now the nuclear unit of Shaw Construction, will work on with TEPCO to build the Texas plant. Lord help us. There's more. Last night I heard CNN reporters repeat the official line that the tsunami disabled the pumps needed to cool the reactors, implying that water unexpectedly got into the diesel generators that run the pumps. These safety backup systems are the EDGS, in the EDGE, in nuclear speak, emergency diesel generators. That they didn't work in an emergency is like a fire department telling us they couldn't save a building because it was on fire. What dim bulbs designed this system? One of the reactors, Dancing with Death at Fukushima Station 1, was built by Toshiba. Toshiba was also an architect of the emergency diesel system.
Now be afraid. Obama's $4 billion bailout in the making is called the South Texas Project. It's been sold as a red, white, and blue way to make power domestically in a reactor from Westinghouse, a great American brand. However, the reactor will be made substantially in Japan by a company that bought the U.S. brand name Westinghouse Toshiba. I once had a Toshiba computer. I only had to send it in once for warranty work. However, it's kind of hard to mail back a reactor with the warranty slip inside the box if the fuel rods are melted and sinking halfway to the Earth's core. TEPCO and Toshiba don't know what my son learned in eighth grade science class. Tsunamis follow Pacific Rim earthquakes. So these companies are real stupid, eh? Maybe. More likely is that the diesels and related systems wouldn't have worked on a fine, dry afternoon.
Back in the day when we checked the emergency backup diesels in America, a mind-blowing number flunked. At the New York nuclear plant, for example, the builders swore under oath that the three diesel engines were ready for an emergency. They'd been tested. The tests were faked. The diesels run for just a short time at low speed. When the diesels were put through a real test under emergency light conditions, the crankshaft on the first one snapped in about an hour, then the second and the third. We nicknamed them diesel Snap, Crackle, and Pop. The forces against independent journalism are growing. Help truth out, keep up the fight against ignorance and regression. Support us. That's a little ad they stuck in the middle. In the U.S., we supposedly fixed our diesels after much complaining by the industry. But in Japan, no one tells TEPCO to do anything the Emperor of Electricity doesn't want to do. I get lots of confidential notes from nuclear industry insiders. One engineer, a big name in the field, is especially concerned that Obama waived the come-hither-check to Toshiba and TEPCO to lure them to America. The U.S. has a long history of whistleblowers willing to put themselves on the line to save the public. In our racketeering case in New York, the government only found out about the seismic test fraud because two courageous engineers, Gordon Dick and John Daly, gave our team the documentary evidence. In Japan, it's simply not done. The culture does not allow the salarymen who work all their lives from one company to drop the dime. Not that U.S. law is a wondrous shield. Both engineers in the New York cases were fired and blacklisted by the industry. Nevertheless, the government brought civil racketeering charges against the builders. The jury didn't buy the corporation's excuse, and in the end, the plant was thankfully dismantled.
Am I on some kind of xenophobic anti-Nippon crusade? No. In fact, I'm far from frightened by the American operators in the South Texas.
I'm far more frightened.
Oh, I'm sorry. Far more frightened by the American operators on the South Texas nuclear project, especially Shaw, Stone, and Webster. Now, the Shaw Nuclear Division, is also the firm that conspired to fake the Edge tests in New York. The company's other exploits have been exposed by their former consultant, John Perkins, in his book Confessions of an Economic Hitman. If the planet wants to shiver, consider this. Toshiba and Shaw have recently signed a deal to become worldwide partners in the construction of nuclear stations. The other characters involved in the South Texas plant that Obama is backing should also give you the willies, but as I'm in the middle of investigating the American partners, I'll save that for another day. So if we turn to America's own nuclear contractors, would we be safe? Well, two of the melting Japanese reactors, including the one whose building blew sky high, were built by General Electric of the good old USA. And after Texas, you're next. The Obama administration is planning a total of $56 billion in loans for nuclear reactors all over America. And now the homicides.
CNN is only interested in body counts. How many workers burnt by radiation, swept away, or lost in the explosion? These plants are now releasing radioactive steam into the atmosphere. Be skeptical about the statements that the levels are not dangerous. These are the same people who said these meltdowns could never happen. Over years, not days, there may be thousands of people, 2,000, 10,000, who will suffer cancers induced by this radiation. In my New York investigation, I had the unhappy job of totaling up post-meltdown morbidity rates for the county government. It would be irresponsible for me to estimate the number of cancer deaths that will recur from these releases without further information, but it's just plain criminal for TEPCO shoguns to say that these releases are not dangerous. Indeed, the fact that residents near the Japanese nuclear plant were not issued iodine pills to keep at the ready shows TEPCO doesn't care who lives and who dies, whether in Japan or in the U.S. The carcinogenic isotopes that are released at Fukushima are already floating to Seattle with effects we simply cannot measure. Heaven help us, because Obama won't. That was from Greg Palast, and he's a frequent contributor to Global Research. Boy, I haven't heard his name or read any research from him in a long time.
Let's see. There was another one on General Electric that I wanted to read. Other forces detained over me. Okay. Yeah, here we go. The idiocy and hubris of engineers. Will GE get whacked for the catastrophic failure of a new plant in Fukushima?
Fukushima.
GE, the company that boasts that it brings good things to life, was the designer of the nuclear plant that are blowing up like hot popcorn kernels in the Fukushima Daiichi generating plant north of Tokyo that was hit by a double whammy of an 8.9 earthquake and a huge tsunami. The company may escape tens of hundreds of billions of dollars in liability from this continuing disaster, which could still result in a catastrophic total meltdown of one or more of the reactors. As of this writing, three reactors are reported to have suffered partial meltdowns, and all could potentially become more serious total meltdowns with a rupture of the reactor's container. Thanks to Japanese law, which makes the operator, in this case Tokyo Electric Power Company, liable. But if it were found that it was design flaws by GE that caused the problem, presumably TEPCO or the Japanese government could pursue GE for damages.
I don't think we need to. Well, that article goes on, and I think it maybe be interesting for people to read if they want to.
Yeah, you can. It's going to be a good. But if you go to Ukrnet, urknet.info, and you'll see it.
By Dave Lindorf.
Yep. Idiocy and Hubris of Engineers.
Give a vote. Oh, this is interesting. The in England, there's a third party being formed, and they really want to let the British people vote on withdrawing from the European Union.
A major political campaign will be launched today aimed at securing a historic referendum on whether Britain should stay in the EU or quit Brussels for good. The cross-party People's Pledge campaign aims to pile pressure on party leaders and MPs to support a poll that would settle the divisive question of EU membership once and for all.
Well, it's not really. I guess it's a cross-party push. I thought it was a separate political party, so I was incorrect.
It hopes to emulate Barack Obama by harnessing the power of the Internet to mobilize support in every constituency. Polling for the campaign launch shows 61% would like a referendum on whether Britain should remain within the European Union, with just 25% against. A majority of supporters of all three parties back the idea. It means support for a referendum on the EU is more than double the level for the referendum on changing Britain's voting system planned for May 5th. Voters will now be invited to sign up to the People's Pledge, promising to only support candidates at the next election who vow to support a referendum. And it goes on. So that's probably good news. Yeah. I think. There was a couple more articles here I wanted to talk
about. I was interested in this one. Go back. This one. The UK wind power experiment in China yields mass pollution. Vast fortunes of being amassed here in Inner Mongolia, the region has more than 90% of the world's reserve of rare earth metals, specifically neodymium, the element needed to make the magnets and the most striking of green energy produces, wind turbines. Live has uncovered the distinctly dirty truth about the process used to extract neodymium. It has an appalling environmental impact that raises serious questions over the credibility of so-called green technology. The reality is that as Britain flaunts its environmental credentials by speckling its coastline in unspoiled moors and mountains with thousands of wind turbines, it's contributing to a vast man-made lake of poison in northern China. This is the deadly and sinister side of the massively profitable rare earth industry that the green companies profiting from the demand for wind turbines would prefer you knew nothing about. It's a huge
scam.
Oh, it's horrible what's happening in China. Just awful. To produce these wind turbines, these magnets that...
Let's see. Live has uncovered live.
You're just repeating what I read. Hidden out of sight behind smoke-shrouded factory complexes in the city of Baotou and patrolled by platoons of security cars lies a five-mile wide tailing lake. It has killed farmland for miles around and made thousands of people ill and put one of China's key waterways in jeopardy. This vast hissing cauldron of chemicals is the dumping ground for 7 million tons of mined rare earth after it has been doused in acid and chemicals and processed through red-hot furnaces to extract its components.
That's 7 million tons a year that they throw in every
year.
The rusting pipelines meander for miles from factories processing rare earths in Baotou out to the main man-made lake where, mixed with water, the foul-smelling radioactive waste from this industrial process is pumped day after day. No signposts and no paved roads lead here, and we approach security guards, shoo us away and tail us. When we finally break through the cordon and climb sand dunes to reach its brim, an apocalyptic sight greets us, a giant secret toxic dump made bigger by every wind turbine we build.
The lake instantly assaults your senses. Stand on the black crust for just a few seconds and your eyes water, and a powerful, acrid stench fills your lungs. For hours after a visit, my stomach lurched and my head throbbed. We were there for only 1 hour, but those who live in Mr. Yan's village of Dalahai and other villages around breathe in the same poison every day. Retired farmer Subaren, 69, who led us to the lake, says it was initially a novelty, a multicolored pond set in farmland as early rare earth factories run by the state-owned Baogong Group of companies began work in the 60s. At first, it was just a hole in the ground, he says. When it dried in the winter and summer, it turned into a black crust and children would play on it. Then one or two of them fell through and drowned in the sludge below. Since then, the children have stayed away. As more factories sprang up, the banks grew higher, the lake grew larger, and the stench and fumes grew more overwhelming. It turned into a mountain that towered over us, says Mr. Sue. Anything we planted just withered, then our animals started to sicken and die. People, too, began to suffer. Dalahai Village says their villages says their teeth began to fall out, their hair turned white at unusually young ages, and they suffered from severe skin and respiratory diseases. Children were born with soft bones, and cancer rates skyrocketed. It's horrible.
Official studies carried out 5 years ago in Dalahai Village confirmed there were unusually high rates of cancer, along with the high rates of osteoporosis and skin and respiratory diseases. The lake radiation levels are 10 times higher than in the surrounding countryside, the study found. And since then, maybe because of pressure from the companies operating around the lake, which pump out waste 24 hours a day, the result of ongoing radiation and toxicity tests carried out on the lake have been kept secret, and officials have refused to publicly acknowledge health risks to nearby villagers. There are 17 rare earth metals. The name doesn't mean that they are necessarily in short supply. It refers to the fact that the metals occur in scattered deposits of minerals rather than concentrated ores. And rare earth metals usually occur together. And once mined, they have to be separated. Sorry, we had a little technical thing going on here.
A little plug came unplugged.
And since then, maybe because of pressure, neodymium is commonly used as part of...
Neodymium?
It's getting a little technical.
Yeah, well, anyway,
I wouldn't
even bother with the rest of this.
But,
The result of this article is that... in order to build these great wind turbines, which Britain puts in its country to keep it pristine, they have to mine
this
diminium, which is a magnet which for these huge wind turbines, and it's just polluting this whole area of China, and the people are dying. It's just a terrible thing. So much for green energy. The cost is that it's killing a lot of innocent Chinese people, and that's not right.
It's bankrupting nations that use it. This is interesting, too. Maybe we've got a minute. There's a Japanese volcano that just erupted.
Yeah, it's a couple of days ago.
Yeah, and there's another thing here that Japan brings money home to rebuild.
They're taking money out of it.
Yeah. Shaken by the prospect of nuclear meltdown. Shaken by the prospect of nuclear meltdown after a devastating earthquake and tsunami, Japanese investors will dump overseas assets on Monday, which they guess they just did, and bring their money home to help finance reconstruction. And positioning for this could send the dollar plummeting versus the yen on Monday and lead to a sharp slide in treasuries, since U.S. government bonds are a favorite asset of Japanese investors. Market analysts said stocks also are likely to come under pressure. So, but that a lot of interesting things happening, and we may wind up if I don't know if John's going to be joining us tonight. But we may wind up doing some more
articles. Yeah, we haven't really heard from him, so we don't know.
Okay, right now we're going to bring on our guest, and her name is Julie Ann Weinstein. She wrote The Flashes from the Outer World. And
interesting little book. And let us tell you just a little bit about Julie Ann Weinstein. She's had several awards as a writer, which is...
I don't know if that's her, though.
I'm not sure who that
could
is.
Yeah, why don't you put her on?
Let's see who this is.
Hello.
Hello, this is Julie.
Okay. You had your number came up very interesting. It came up 1111111.
Goodness. Well, that's a flash from the other world.
Yes. Well, and it's interesting because you write a lot about the other world. So I said, gee, I wonder if that's Julie or not.
The reason I ask is because a lot of times callers block their numbers by doing that. So, I wasn't sure if it was you or not.
I was going to tell the listeners a little bit about you yourself, but why don't you tell them about yourself a little bit? Give them a little clue as to who you are, how long you've been writing, and I know that you've had some awards. So talk a little bit about that.
Certainly. I'm happy to be here. Flashes from the Other World is a culmination of my short fiction for the past 5 to 7 years. I've been writing in one form or another all my life, from poetry to short fiction to novels, and of course also marketing copy, any and everything I've written. Fiction is my favorite, but you know, there's lots of glimpses from all worlds. Every, you know, writers are sponges. Everything we touch comes into our world. As you mentioned, I have won some awards. I've been nominated for different awards. Most recently, there was a contest with A Word With You Press. I was a semifinalist in some of those, as well as my second novel was a semifinalist in Amazon's Breakthrough Novel Contest.
Well, congratulations.
And my stories typically are kind of wild and wacky, a mix of the other world and this world. By that I mean I'm naturally intuitive, and I kind of sense the bridge between both places. And it's kind of, I think, when you have a little bit of the other world mixed with this world, there's a little more escapism.
Yeah, I was particularly interested in that. Have you, you're writing about the other world. Have you had personal experiences with the other world?
Yes, quite a bit. Just the past couple of weeks, a lamp was broken in my house, and it was an opportunity for every light to flicker at different times until the lamp was fixed. It was hilarious. Every single light took its turn flickering.
Well, you write a lot about ghosts. If you have personal experience with that.
Yes, I've seen ghosts. I've sensed ghosts. I dream of communication with my grandma that's no longer here. And I also see sometimes a flash of orbs, which I've been told is often a way that the spirits communicate with us.
Mm-hmm. And how do you get your communication?
Well, it's the way I look at it. It's like, you know, we're talking on the radio right now. Sometimes it's staticky. Sometimes something comes in.
Have you had any particular revelations that have helped you? I mean, is it like a guiding force that you write a lot about grandmothers, and you talked about your grandma a minute ago. Is your grandmother a guiding force in your writing?
Very much so. I mean, for a long time, I kept having, after my grandma passed away, I kept having this desire to do a fictionalized series with a grandma character. And it is fiction, but I sense that, you know, at times when I'm writing it, that my grandma's kind of looking over my shoulder. You know, every once in a while, I'll type the word yes, and the words eyes pop out on my computer screen, which I just find really amusing. It's a presence, I would say. It's not a guiding force. I mean, at times I do feel like ideas come to me, but I wouldn't say it's a direct thing. It's more like, you know, inspiration comes just as easily. If I go running on the beach, I'll see something. It's just another source of an idea.
Okay.
But it's abstract. I mean, the way I look, the kind of fiction I write is very typically described as magic realism. And I don't know if you're familiar with that or if the listeners are.
No, I'm not. Can you tell what that is exactly?
Yeah, very briefly. It's a type of fiction that became really popular in Latin America with Gabriela Garcia Marquez, Isabel Allende. And the way I view it, it's reality that gets slightly bent. Like if you think of science fiction that has a lot of bends and curves, this is reality that we still recognize, but that has a little whimsical. Like in my writing, it may be anything from a ghost talking to, you know, somebody becoming a snail or a mosquito. I have Elvis and the elephants communicating. You know, it's just that mystical, magical wonder in the everyday.
Well, it's a very clever form. I liked it, and I found it. Is it very difficult to write so completely and get your message across in such a small number of words? Is it a difficult process?
Yeah, it's kind of like Twitter.
I find it actually easier. I'm working on a novel and stories right now, and everything that I take out in a short fiction, for instance, I view it as cutting to the core. When you have in my book Flashes from the Other World, there are many stories that are all of a page and a half.
Yes.
And they're stories that have the core. If you think of an apple, the peel is the backstory and any kind of setup. And in a very tiny story, you don't have space for that. So everything is, you're immediately in the world of the characters. You can think of it kind of as a one-act play. You know, it's like the Twitter of fiction, except for it's a little longer.
Now, do you envision any of your little shorts being filmed?
Oh, I would love that if it happened. I have had at different times Hollywood people talk to me. And, you know, my agent is now working on some film opportunities, Sandra Dykstra Agency. So, you know, that's always a window that I would welcome.
Or even put together as a play.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. I think that many of them are very cinematic. I mean, some people compare what I'm doing with my fiction to, like, the Twilight Zone merged with the Three Stooges, because there's that mix of wonderment and the other world.
Ah, yes, that's a good way to describe it, a very interesting way to describe it.
Yeah, it's kind of that playfulness. I mean, there are deep, longing emotions, you know, of connection, but there's, you know, in my book, I often call it, you know, 70 mini worlds. You know, these are escapes, and if you're going to take a little vacation, you want to have some fun and also, you know, have a laugh and maybe a tear, but at the end of the day, feel good from the journey.
I know, for some reason maybe because I wasn't really certain as I was going through this, but it kind of gave, I felt like I was reading a girl's diary, you know, like diary entries or something, you know.
Yeah, and, it has, some of them are written for that stream of consciousness feel, absolutely.
That's exactly what I thought, and I said, I really didn't know how to take it because I'm also an author. I've written books and thousands of poems and articles, and but I've never really some of these things I noticed. After I read it, I tried to write a couple off the top of my head, and it is kind of fun.
Oh, absolutely. I love writing flash fiction, the very, very short stories that this collection's filled with. Regularly, you just toss some words on the screen and have fun with it.
Yeah, and I kind of did, and I was just playing around with it to see what I could come up with. I don't think I was ever familiar with flash writing. I mean, this reminds me, it's kind of like what I do on my website when I write an entry, it could be 10 pages long or it could be 10 lines, you know, what I have to feel that I have to write that day. And,
well, flash fiction, it's designed for, I mean, it's always been around in one form or another, but it's become particularly popular with online and, it's the size of a notebook computer, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
you know, or, you know, people, short attention span, you know, very much is here and now in this day and age. So it's, you know, people have time for very short stories, but some people don't have time for novels like they used to.
Well, that's true. So you can, you'd be able to reach a wider audience, certainly.
Well, what kind of reaction are you getting to it?
I've been getting some really excellent reviews. Midwest reviewed, you know, this is just one of the really quick things. Stories Wild and Wacky, Scary, Secretive, Magical, and Free. I've gotten a lot of excellent reviews on Amazon. And the book was recently released on Barnes & Noble, so it's been getting some nice reviews there as well.
How long have you been writing in this style?
I've been writing flash fiction the past 3 or 4 years. I also write books. I mean, I do the small, medium, and large. Very often I'll test out an idea in flash fiction, and then if the theme keeps occurring, then I may explore it as a short story and eventually a book. Five of the stories that are in Flashes from the Other World are in my current book, The Ruby Lucy, that I'm in the midst of editing.
So it's a good place to start then. Would you recommend as a way for writers to kind of like test the waters and then expand?
Yes. Well, what's beautiful to me and very appealing with flash fiction is the distinct beginning, middles, and ends. And you have the ability to cut to the core. So if you know the core of the story, even if it's in its flash fiction form, it's easy to add to it because you know what it's about. And, with the longer work, sometimes it takes a while to find that out.
I was thinking it'd be a great way to teach writing.
Oh, yeah. I give a lot of workshops on flash fiction. I recently gave a workshop at the Southern California Writers Conference, and it's a lot of fun to just get people to test out ideas and cut to the core in a story.
Well, also, it must be very satisfying because you have a product much more quickly.
Mm-hmm. I love having a beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah. That's always satisfying to have a product, I think.
As a writer, and then you can get the word out, you know, back to what Leo was saying, you get something out quick.
That's
and
right.
It's a way to reach a larger audience quicker.
And I think what you said a little while back is that it's very appealing to today's world to have something short and something that people can get into right away and finish.
Yes, and the meaning can be just as poignant as a longer piece.
Mm-hmm. Now, besides writing, are you doing other things too? You're giving workshops as well?
I am giving workshops on flash fiction, and I'm also exploring doing some workshops on creativity to get people kind of open their mindset to new ideas and new sources of inspiration.
Mm-hmm. And how do you go about doing that in your workshop on creativity?
I'm very active in the Southern California writers community, so we'll probably start here. Just, you know, word of mouth and networking. And, of course, you know, Facebook, blogging. You know, my blog is flashesfromtheotherworld.com, and then at my website, julieweinstein.com.
I meant to ask you about your publishing house. The All Things That Matter Press. I was just looking it up here. No fee royalty paying. What does that
they
mean?
Are a small press.
Yeah, seeks to publish those books that have helped the author share their self with the world. So what is their mission, actually?
If I could summarize it pretty quick, I'd say they look for books that have a distinct message and a different kind of voice. Having met many of the authors, that's what kind of unites us.
So how did you come across them, or how did you find
them? Noticed them on duotrope.com. I was looking, you know, for a small press publisher while I was, you know, also working on my novels. And, you know, it looked like a good way to get the stories out to continue to build my brand.
Yeah, no, I was curious because it was an odd book, and I wondered how it was received
It's been getting a lot of really good reviews. The book was in a slightly, back in 2006, I had a much shorter version of Flashes. It was actually Flashes of the Other World, released by another small press, PulpBits.com. I think they got absorbed by something else, but it was, you know, so I was getting all these reviews for it, and then I had an agent at the time working on my other books, and I kind of said, you know, let me just keep writing more short stories, and it was always a plan of mine to release get some publishers interested to release a short story collection.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that sounds very good. No, I was curious, what other, I'm kind of looking here, but what, so they're kind of an experimental publisher, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
Well, I think when authors look at a small press, it's different than when you look at a larger publisher. Like, you know, the agents typically go after the larger publishers, and that, to me, that's more ideal for novels. A lot of the publishers don't want to, a lot of the bigger publishers don't want to take a chance on shorter fiction, typically.
Mm-hmm.
Unless, the stories have been, if the author's extensively known.
Right.
My agent is where, the Dykstra Agency is also talking to people overseas. So, one never knows, where my next books will go. An author, it takes a while to build an author's name and career,
Right. Have they put it out in ebook as well? Are you finding that to be the, a lot of ebook buyers?
Oh, definitely. It's on Amazon Kindle. It's been doing pretty well as an ebook. It's also Amazon UK is an ebook too.
I'm glad.
I'm waiting for it to get released as an ebook on Barnes and Noble, but right now it is on Barnes and Noble paperback on their online system.
Great. That's really exciting. So tell us more about this. We still have a few minutes. What is your? I still have a hard time grasping this because I read a number of the short things, but because they were from such a feminine perspective, I cringed and kind of didn't really know what Lila liked it and she liked your story. I was not sure of it because, for one thing, it's interesting, but I didn't. But for men,
you didn't find that you related to it.
I didn't relate to any of it, But that's purely from a masculine point of view.
Well, everybody's taste in fiction is totally different. I mean, at the core, they're universal stories of emotional longing connections. It's not unique to men or women. It's all of us, humanity.
No, I understand that. But, just certain things like, I'm not putting it down. I'm just saying that looking at it from a cockeyed perspective of a male reading these things,
Well, I realize my fictions, everybody has, their own perspective and taste. Lila, what resonated for you with the collection?
What resonated with me was I liked when you talked about your grandmother and I could feel myself with some influences that I've had myself when being asleep and in a dream like state from my parents, so I connected very much to a lot of your stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that I've been hearing a lot of reaction from female readers, so it's possible that more females do connect more to my fiction. Although some of my long-term fans are male, everybody has such a unique perspective on what they want to read and what they like, and from their own unique perspective in the world.
And what I liked is that, you can read a few pages and then put it down and you've completed what you've read. You've completed, like you said, the beginning, the middle, the end. And
mm-hmm. you know where you're going and you know where you've been. And then you can go have another adventure a couple pages later.
Right. And I don't have as much time for reading as I used to, especially fiction. So this style really appeals to me.
Yeah, I feel the same way as a reader, as much as a writer. I'm always reading books, but I seem to get a couple chapters here and there. So, when I can get into good fiction that's short, it's wonderful because I know I'll have time for 10 pages or 5 or 3, but not
that's
always
right.
The full commitment of a novel until I go on a vacation.
Exactly. That's why this appealed to me, and most of my reading is nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't have very much time when I'm not on vacation to read a fiction book. So this was great, and I can put it in my bag and take it to work and read a little bit at lunch if I want to or on a break. So I like the idea of this kind of book and this kind of style, which I wasn't familiar with until your sample came.
Oh,
and
good.
I was very happy to see that. And also, as I said, I connected with what you write about in The Dreamlike State. And it was great to read somebody else's. I felt it was that a lot of what you had written was a personal experience. And I felt that you must have had a connection with your grandmother or someone in your family to write so personally.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even if it was, I would say it's 90% of what I wrote in Flashes from the Other World is fictional, but the triggers, the ideas of the story came from my real life.
Mm-hmm.
So even though it's fiction, there is that, light brush of reality that comes into it.
Well, you could feel that in the writing, and that's great. When people write about their own, put their own personal experiences into their writing, it's so much realer and so much, and you connect so much better.
Definitely. I feel that way, too.
Now, one of the questions that you sent, or someone sent, which I was just looking at, which is interesting. Wait a minute.
Yeah,
let me finish this.
Yeah, I did want to. Yeah, go ahead.
It's one of the questions that I thought was interesting that I wanted to ask that had come with your book is how is your book different from science fiction or other ghost stories, would you say?
Well, with science fiction, back to that mini curve level, this is one major curve as opposed to like science fiction, you're going to take a huge detour from your regular world. This is a little curve. It's like you're turning left. And then you turn right, and you're going to be back into your world. So it's the glimpse, and it's that merging of the two states.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Go ahead, Leo. You had a question.
No, I just wanted to say that I appreciate your publicist Jenna was very persistent, and I agreed to the book, not really knowing what to expect, but I wanted to congratulate your publicist there because she's quite persistent. This is
Jenna's phenomenal. What a sweetheart!
I wanted you to tell her that she
does good work for you.
Yeah, she was one of the main reasons that I got it because she followed up, and I had misplaced the original book a few months back when she first sent it. So, is there anything else you'd like to talk to us about the book?
Well, at this time, I could read a very, very, very short story from the book.
That would be fine.
Okay. Maybe I'll read Camp Ghost. It's really short. Camp Ghost, and again, what we were talking with Lila, story was inspired by camp as a Girl Scout. Lured by the ghost ships in the middle of the night, we crossed the railroad tracks and touched the sand. The shoulders of white-capped waves looked translucent like ships, all the things we Girl Scouts couldn't be. Mesmerized, some girls went into the water. Those still in the sand held their breath, waiting for them to surface. If you stared long enough, you'd see a girl body surfing, a ghostly hand propping her up, the crest of a sail amidst an old man's chuckle. He's the one, they say, who carried Sally onto the ship. The rest of us got into trouble for sneaking out of camp, But Sally, we called after the camp counselor, who dragged us back to our tents. She made us stay inside and stood guard for minutes that felt like hours. We held our breaths, hyperventilating in allegiance with Sally until she left. Allison and I crawled out the back side of the tent and ran to the beach, intent on saving Sally. We found her clammy in the sand. The old man's chuckle rose from her belly. The voice, hers, yet not hers, beckoned us into the water. Some say we surfed the night, but I saw the mast and the steering wheel and smelled the old man's salty breath.
That's quite a good one.
Thank you.
That was one that I enjoyed. I thought it was very good. And if our listeners would like to get your book, how can they do that?
Well, Flashes from the Other World is on Amazon, both as a paperback and Kindle, and it's also on BarnesandNoble.com
okay.
as well.
Great.
Very good.
And you have a website. Would you tell our listeners again what that is?
Well, the easiest is FlashesFromTheOtherWorld.com, and then my personal website is JulieWeinstein.com. Weinstein's like Einstein, but with a W.
Okay. And we thank you very much for being on our show, and it was a pleasure talking to you, Julie, and good luck with your books.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
That was Julie Weinstein talking about her book, Flashes from the Other World. Excellent book. And for today's fast-paced world, you can get a real quick shot of fiction and the other side without spending hours. And as she said, you get a beginning, a middle, and an end very quickly. And it was a new form of fiction writing for me, although apparently it's been popular in South America and actually has a name to it.
I kind of got a kick out of the style, but
okay,
I was not. Let me finish, for crying out loud.
No, I want to go back to the website, to the site.
Because what site?
Where are we at? Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you're on there. What are you talking about?
Just go back to Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, well, I was going to plug All Things That Matter Press, since they're the publishers of this book,
okay.
And you can actually buy the book from them. Okay, and she'd probably do better buying it from them than you would buying it from Amazon. All right. In other words,
the author, only $5.99.
Right, and the author will do better, you know, with that. So you can go to allthingsthatmatterpress.com and check it out. All right, that's what I was going to say. But in the meantime, I think it's definitely. It wasn't my kind of book, but that's the second book that I had no connection to that you had a full connection to.
Huh.
Remember that other book that I forgot what it was. Something about the woman in the tree or something that you remember the spiritual woman that.
Oh, yeah.
Got involved with the woods or something.
Yeah,
or
it was a very interesting book. I forgot.
And you both happened to have the same childhood
the same
book club.
That we liked. So, yeah, we were connected.
So,
I think that you found the genre hard because you're not familiar with it. And
no, I found the genre, not the genre hard. I just found that I have problems reading female books. Right? You know, it's like.
That sounds like a very sexist remark.
It is, but I can't get into these female characters. It's just not me, you know. Like, not that it's not good. And thank God for the publishing industry that most women are the biggest readers of this stuff. But summer flip flops, you know, the vacation tub. These are some of the titles that have gone, but. You know, a lot of it's like itchy feet.
Well, okay.
But,
uh,
stuff like...
Well, I think a book that you choose is a very personal thing, and
this one didn't
appeal to you, but it didn't to me.
It's not the kind of book that I would have bought personally, because it's not one that I, you know... Once you read it, as a guy reading this stuff, you know, I mean, maybe a younger guy or a guy more inclined to read feminine books, might like it. But a guy who's used to reading books like I read, it's not, you know, it's not in the genre that I usually do.
Well, I'm going to put on for In the Ring with Woody. He's on the line.
Is he on the line?
Yep.
Okay.
So
good.
Let me do
but
that.
But anyway, go to all whatever it was, Flashes from the Other World. And see for yourself, and for $5.99 you can't, or whatever the price is, you can't, can't really lose.
Okay, so... Into the ring with Woody.
Nope. Are you with us, Woody?
Oh, no wonder we can't hear
you.
No, my fault. Step into the ring with Woody.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Could you hear us all right?
Yes, I can.
Okay, we played your music, but I had your mic off, so did you hear it or not?
Yeah, no, I absolutely heard it.
Okay, good. All right.
I'm good to go? You played my music and I'm good, right?
Yep, you're stepping right into the ring.
Oh, thank you. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, NFL talk stall, NBA news, and of course, some baseball. Moving right along, let's get down to the NFL talks. Drew Brees, one of the 10 named plaintiffs in the sweeping antitrust lawsuit, Tom Brady versus the NFL, insists he is committed to taking pro football's labor battle to federal court. Yet the New Orleans Saints quarterback, part of the NFL Players Association bargaining team when talks collapsed last week, still sees a window for negotiation before an April 6 hearing for an injunction to stop the lockout instituted by NFL owners. Brees said, "We're going to let the process take its course." That was during a conference call Monday that included fellow NFLPA executive committee members. But any realistic proposal, or if they'd like to provide those 10 years of audited financials to a third party that we can get some answers on to reach a fair deal, I'm sure we'd be open to that. What he's referring to is projected earnings for the league. The owners don't want to give it up. Basically, what you have here is billionaires arguing over money with millionaires. The billionaires obviously being the owners, and the millionaires being the players, guys paid millions of dollars to play a child's game. The average fan, for the most part, usually sides with the owners just because they see an owner as, you know, like a boss, and that they have a right to make certain demands and the players as just, you know, overpaid sports guys. I don't know. I find it kind of strange. You know, sports guys are looked on as overpaid, but then you have guys that are doing movies that are like overpaid exorbitant amounts of money for movies that are absolutely garbage. And same goes for some music stars, but yet the public, you know, has no problem, you know, with the Rolling Stones making millions of dollars, or, you know, Brad Pitt making, you know, $10 million a picture, and, you know, every picture is worse than the next. But anyway, I don't know, it just seems that people always have it out for the players. I'm on the players' side on this one. Anyway, while the NFLPA is no longer authorized to collectively bargain for a new agreement after decertifying and technically becoming a trade association Friday, the class action lawsuit by players can be settled out of court. Brees is holding his breath that such would occur before this first court date. We are very much about the process that we'd be forced into at this point, he said, which is decertification and the injunction to block this lockout. Breeze and Indianapolis coach center Jeff Saturday and retired players Sean Morey and Kevin Moway, the union president, spoke to news reporters for nearly an hour in the first public comments by executive committee members since the lockout. To a man, they expressed frustration that talks had disintegrated to the point that the NFL had its work stoppage in nearly might have its first work stoppage in 24 years. They remain staunch in their demand that owners provide more financial data. The league maintains it has offered 5 years of data to a third party and characterized the NFL's last-ditch offer Friday as a public relations move. A lot of it, I think, was all a front, Brees said, all a show with no real intent to get a deal done, except to say they made a proposal. True story, Brees is definitely telling the truth on that one. Negotiations might not have broken off. The player said had the owners presented their proposal earlier in the week. However, none expressed any desire to extend the talks further to allow more time to consider details of the extensive proposal. The first 4 days last week, we were sitting there not getting anything done, Saturday said. It seems odd that you wait until Friday to put out a 20-point proposal. There's just no way. It's like trying to throw an enormous amount of information on someone right before a deadline to push something through. Other issues at hand, Brees said it didn't really matter that Judge David Doty, who has repeatedly ruled in favor of the players while overseeing the collective bargaining agreement since his inception in 1993, wouldn't hear the lockout injunction case. That was something owners that seemed to be very concerned about. You know, he constantly has ruled against them, and now, you know, he's not going to be able to do that. According to Brees, for them, it's, you know, it's about the facts and it's about the law. Now, although the owners' last proposal backed off plans for an 18-game season, for 11 and 12, players would never agree to that schedule, according to Maywee. We cannot justify for the safety and health of our players, he said. 18 games was taken off the table the first time they proposed it. Now, my personal opinion is that 18-game season is going to happen. It's probably the last bargaining chip that the players have. I would expect a shortened preseason, an 18-game regular season with two separate buys, you know, so each team would have two buys instead of just one. You know, as I said, this is billionaires and millionaires fighting over millions of dollars. I certainly hope in the NFL, you know, that they, you know, don't have a lockout. If they do, I think they realize that, the scabs that they had played last time, you know, really wasn't a good showing for the NFL. You know, again, if they don't have a season, you know, it's certainly going to be a shame, and they're going to lose a whole lot of money. But, you know, in the long run, it's not costing me a dime if they don't play. So I'm sure I can find something on cable to watch on Sunday or find something else to do. If they don't want to play, and you know, then let it be. You know, let them fight over their millions. They can all sleep on beds full of money. Anyway, moving forward. TNT analysts and big mouth Charles Barkley ripped the New York Knicks, and rightly so, for their plan to hike season ticket prices by 49%. Barkley said that was a disgrace, a flat-out disgrace. He said that in an interview earlier in the week on a WFAN. Come on, that's not fair at all to raise tickets that much, and I understand that all these guys are trying to make money, but 50% is a little extreme. Let me rephrase that. That's a lot extreme. The Knicks hadn't raised season ticket prices over the last 6 years because of owner James Dolan's policy of not raising them when the team doesn't make the playoffs. So, you know, fans will pay for an expected playoff berth out of their collective wallets this season. According to Barkley, the Knicks have been sticking for a long time. Those fans have always been loyal. And for them to jab them like that with a 50% increase, that's unfair. Rarely do I agree with Barkley. I think he's a bit of an idiot. You know, he seems to have an opinion on everything. Yeah, some stuff he's right, sometimes he's wrong. In this case, I'm definitely going to take his side. For the Knicks to raise their prices like that is just absolutely a punch in the face for every Knicks fan that has had to go to any game at Madison Square Garden for the last 6 years, where the Knicks have just put out putrid team after putrid team. And just to raise the price like that is just, it's just absolutely disgusting. But, you know, that's kind of what sports has come down to now. It's all about the dollars. Bulls forward and my favorite team, from the Chicago Bulls. Carlos Boozer remains day-to-day, even though he sprained his left ankle and continues to improve. Boozer was still limping slightly yesterday and is not sure when he'll return. He's the team's second-leading scorer and rebounder. He missed the past two games after an awkward landing during a flagrant foul by former prodigy Kwame Brown in a win last week at Sharp. Bulls host Washington tonight before visiting New Jersey and Indiana on Thursday and Friday. Coach Tom Thibodeau hopes to have him back within a week. The Bulls have won 13 of 15 and trail the Eastern Conference leader Boston by only half a game. They've played well without Boozer, and they had a couple easy wins over Atlanta and I believe Utah. Moving forward, a little bit of baseball talk. Many people have spoken ill of Jorge Posada and, you know, his ability to make the transition from catcher to DH. You know, they say he's an ornery guy. He's uncooperative. I've always said, you know, if they made him DH full-time, that he would, you know, he would just have to acquiesce. And that seems to be what the process is. Now that he knows that, you know, that's what the deal is. You know, you're DHing, you're not catching, and then that's the end of it. Don't ruin your Yankee legacy. Just suck it up and DH for a year. And, you know, he'll probably have some great at-bats this year. The Yankees have not used Posada for a single inning behind the plate this spring at all. He's played a little bit of first base just in case they need him to back up to Shera, but they've kept him out of his catching gear. Last year, Posada struggled when he played at designated hitter while recovering from a broken foot. He could not find a routine that worked for him, and he seemed annoyed, you know, that the Yankees were keeping him from catching. You know, as I said, he's somewhat ornery. According to hitting coach Long, I think it's completely different. When your mindset is, I'm a catcher, this DHing stuff, I'm not into it because that's not my role. Well, my role now is to help the team win ball games defensively, offensively. I think that mindset, you know, that's his new mindset. You know, that, you know, he doesn't, the defensive stuff, that's out of his mind. You know, he needs to be an offensive threat now, and that's it. And, you know, he has to, you know, believe that he's here to help the team any way he can. He just wants to be able to contribute. Posada's been working on what he will do between at-bats to stay focused on the game. According to Posada, somebody told him to go outside for an at-bat, probably 30 minutes before your at-bat, or maybe 20 minutes or so, just to get used to the lights of the sun. Former Yankee Hideki Matsui struggled when he became a full-time DH because he spent too much time in the video room dissecting pitchers, Long said, and Posada has avoided falling into that trap. According to Long, he'll figure out a routine as we go along. So that's good news out of Yankee camp. It's pretty much what I believed all along. You know, Posada just didn't want to give up the reins, but, you know, now he realizes he's out of the mix, no more behind the plate. You know, you want to get playing time. That's what you got to do. Posada, he's in the last year of his contract. I don't see him coming. I don't see the Yankees re-signing him. I'm not sure if someone, you know, if after he sits down after this season, you know, is he really going to want to go catch part-time somewhere? Or is he going to want to go DH full-time somewhere else in the American League, you know? Maybe gets a little career extension here. He can just be like a DH guy. You know, I mean, without him being behind the plate, that takes away a lot of the dings and bang-ups and everything else that you go through during the long season. You know, when you're catching 110, 115 games, 120 games, it's really hard on the body. And without all that, you know, a lot of times Posada's been at the plate and he's been hurt. Well, I think his bat is really going to add some spark into the lineup this year. I think he's really going to be a threat. I think he's probably going to have one of the bigger years he's had in a long time. And obviously that's due to him no longer being behind the plate. But, hey, you got to replace, you know, you got to put youth in some positions here because this Yankee team is, you know, not especially youthful. A little more about the Yankees. Jabba Chamberlain and Sergio Mitre both have been sidelined with tightness in their left oblique muscles. But the Yankees say neither injury is serious. Chamberlain felt some discomfort after throwing a pitch last Friday. He worked out yesterday. I guess he says he felt fine. The hope is the reliever can throw maybe Thursday. You know, Mitre was scheduled to start in the game against the Red Sox, but was scratched in favor of Manuel Benulis. Mitre woke up with tightness in the muscle Sunday, but he still wanted to pitch last night. Considering he missed 5 weeks last year with a strain in the same oblique, the Yankees, you know, they want to opt him aside of caution and, you know, hope he can pitch on Thursday. According to me, Tracy, they wanted to pitch. He told me it was just a little soreness, just a little treatment, and I'll be fine, but they decided to take a couple more days on the safe side. Yankees manager Joe Girardi said a setback will not affect Mitre's standing in the race for the final two spots in rotation. Yankees believe the injury will cost Mitre a few days, not weeks. Right now, it's a low-level concern, according to general manager Brian Cashman. Girardi said he could announce in what order A.J. Burnett and Phil Hughes will pitch in the regular season as soon as tomorrow. Girardi said the staff has talked about it, but no decision has been made final. My personal opinion on that is I say don't move Burnett out of the number two slot. Anything that can just screw up this dude's head, you definitely do not want to do. You do not want him thinking he's no longer a number two guy. Phil Hughes, it probably doesn't make a difference. Even though the guy is young, the guy's a pro. And, you know, he knows his day is coming. I just think that if you move Burnett to number three, it just kind of messes with his head a little bit. And that's not something you want to do. So, I don't know. As far as the Yankees, the two guys that I think are probably going to clean, you know, the two spots that are up for grabs. And if it was me and I was making the pick, I would go with Garcia and I would take Nova. Nova's a young guy. Garcia is an innings eater, and he's, you know, he's pitched well last year for Chicago. Nova's a young guy. The only question you have on him is his arm strength up to par? Last year he used to fade after five innings or so. You know, has he gained in arm strength? You know, what has he gained over the break? You know, I think that'll be interesting to see. But that's certainly what I would do. You know, but you know, I'm obviously not in charge. A little bit of bad luck has struck the Philadelphia Phillies. Brad Lidge, I guess he has a sore arm. That's going to keep him off the mound for a few days. That doesn't surprise me. To me, you know, they've got that lineup and, you know, the Philadelphia pitchers, and they're acting like these guys, you know, all walk on water. I've always said Lidge has been the weak link in that chain. And, you know, he's a small guy. He throws very hard. And that's tough on the muscles, tough on the back, tough on the legs, and we'll see. But I bet he doesn't have a big year. But, you know, that could be a little bit hating, but whatever. We'll just have to wait and see. Anyway, that's it for this week. Shout-out to all my Woodsheads out there, Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg at AFS, everyone at the Northeast Athletic Club. Stay tuned. Hopefully we'll get some warm weather.
Great. Thank you. That was Burnt Rubber Blues. And now, how about All You Can Eat?
And Lila's favorite, yeah.
Yeah, I like this one. Enjoy, folks.
Drug from their doctor. In 2009, pharmaceutical industry spent an estimated $4.5 billion on such advertising. Total 2007 U.S. pharmaceutical industry sales were $315 billion.
The DTC, or direct-to-consumer ads, give viewers the illusion that they can and should be their own doctor. They are designed to make viewers believe that they can and should prescribe for themselves. By fostering a false sense of demand for prescription-required drugs, direct-to-consumer drug ads undermine the real knowledge that doctors should have when, in consultation with the patient, a treatment plan is established. Next time you see one of these ads, make sure you're aware of the detailed risk factors that are either buried at the bottom of the page or mentioned at the commercial's end. These risks tell only half the story of the drug's real potential harm. The other half usually doesn't get told. How the pharmaceutical industry is harming the health of America.
Federal regulation of drugs was the result of public outrage over scandal exposed by early 20th century muckrakers, most notably Upton Sinclair, who revealed widespread adulterated food products and poisonous patent medicines. This led to the passage of the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906. In 1938, Congress passed the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act that gave the FDA authority over drug company marketing materials. In 1962, the FDA authority was further extended to regulate advertisement of prescription drugs.
However, things began to change in the 1980s. In 1981, Merck published the first DTC ad for prescription drugs. Remember, direct-to-consumer?
Yep.
Pneumovox. In Reader's Digest, it was followed by numerous print ads, and in 1983, the first television prescription drug ad for Boots Pharmaceuticals Rufin Prescription Strength Ibuprofen. Over the next decade plus, the pharmaceutical industry, emboldened by the Reagan-era belief in limited government, steadily pushed to deregulate direct-to-consumer ads. In 1997, the FDA loosened advertising rules, leading to an enormous increase in direct-to-consumer ad spending.
So we could thank Reagan and his Alzheimer's for that.
Yeah. For example, in 1996, less than $1 billion was spent on direct-to-consumer ads out of the industry's total promotional spending of $11.4 billion. In 2005, total pharma promotional spending nearly tripled to $29.9 billion, and the amount spent on DTC ads quadrupled to $4.2 billion.
Yeah, and that is because that's why then television is completely owned by pharmaceutical ads.
Yeah,
it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. And
groundbreaking new UN report on how to feed the world's hungry. Ditch corporate-controlled agriculture.
There are a billion hungry people in the world, and that number could rise as food insecurity increases along with population growth, economic fallout, and environmental crisis. But a roadmap to defeating hunger exists if we can follow the course, and that course involves ditching corporate-controlled, chemical-intensive farming.
To feed 9 billion people in 2050, we urgently need to adopt the most efficient farming techniques available. And today's scientific evidence demonstrates that agroecological methods outperform the use of chemical fertilizers in boosting food production in regions where the hungry live, says Oliver Duschutter, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food Agroecology, is more or less right to food. Agroecology is more or less what many Americans would simply call organic agriculture, although important nuances separate the two terms. Used successfully by peasant farmers worldwide, agroecology applies ecology to agriculture in order to optimize long-term food production, requiring few purchase inputs and increasing soil quality, carbon sequestration, and biodiversity over time. Agroecology also values traditional and indigenous farming methods, studying the scientific principles underpinning them instead of merely seeking to replace them with new technologies. As such, agroecology is grounded in local resources.
Yeah. You want to continue, Ed? We can get along.
Okay.
But, you know, agroecology is the way to go, organic farming. And let me check here and see if there's something else we can do.
Yeah, they didn't have too many health ones on.
Well, what I wanted to do is I wanted to go to see if we could pick up
let's see if we have a few more health ones. See if there's something on YouTube that we could play that will.
It appears that we're not going to have our buddy John with us tonight, so let us moveon.org.
Go to our health site.
Well, wait a minute. I just want to see this.
And that's where you get all that.
Yeah.
You get health.
Yeah.
And you get a lot of from where you find it. Leo is looking for something right now, so let's try to go to the health site that we like so much. Let's go to that. And that's where you find things on health.
Well, no kidding. What I wanted to do was...
Maybe we could find something on chemtrails to play?
Yep. See what we got.
Chemtrails 2011. Or a lot of those are probably just... Chemtrails, Alex Jones might be good, because people haven't heard that.
You know what? I think you're right about that. You know what bugs me more than anything?
Genetically modified food?
Yeah, or organisms, or...
Mm-hmm.
Genetically modified humans?
Well, I don't know what that is exactly. We will be after we've eaten all this stuff. We'll be genetically modified.
Genetically modified. Why not? Let's try humans.
Well, we are after we eat it. We become genetically modified because it becomes...
No dangers of genetically modified foods.
We should probably say that. That's probably...
Yeah, and before mutated genetically modified animals.
Mm-hmm.
Genetically engineered... Open source food and genetic engineering.
Well, just play that one. Maybe.
Yeah, I just wanted to double check and see if there was anything more interesting, but that one sounds pretty good.
Let's see what he has to say.
Health dangers of genetically modified foods. This is a lecture by Jeffrey Smith in which he summarizes the contents of this book. It's not only informative but amusing because he casts a real spell or whatever.
Studying this quite in depth for some time, and when Jeffrey Smith brought his book out and I sat down and read that book, I said, whoa, this is the book we've been waiting for. This is the book that everybody in America needs to read. So I'm so pleased that you're here. I'll let Jeffrey fill you in a little bit of his background and how he came into this issue, and so I bring you Jeffrey Smith.
Crowd. It's fantastic to see you all here. How many people are concerned about eating genetically modified foods?
Everybody raising their hand.
All right, so I'm preaching to the choir tonight. I say I'm arming the choir. How many people try to actively avoid eating genetically modified foods? Wow. Now keep your hands up for just a second. Now, keep your hands up if you know which foods are genetically modified. I find that amazing. So many people consciously try and avoid it, they don't know which foods are. And that, by the way, Craig Winters is your champion. He is the man in charge of the labeling campaign, the big labeling campaign on Earth in the United States. Let's give Craig a big hand. He's a hero. He is definitely a hero. And how many people were born and raised in Florida? I just wanted to find out. That many, huh? Both of you. So I want to talk about the dangers of genetically modified foods and the cover-up of those dangers. And people have all sorts of reactions to this information. Now, you can choose which emotion you want to respond to, but I would like to encourage you to take that emotion and convert it into energy units. Maybe that energy unit or the action unit takes the form of filling out your letter to the congressperson and passing on the rest to the other five. Maybe that action unit takes the form of being more vigilant in actually avoiding genetically modified foods and studying the issue more closely. I invite you to sign up also for my electronic newsletter. By the way, Craig's is fantastic. It's every week. I read it every week. And mine is a little more semi-whenever. Whenever I get back from some trip, I'll put together a journal of what happened. But I invite you to sign up for that also. But whatever you do tonight, you can choose to make this night a turning point in your digestive life. You can choose for tonight to be a turning point in your choices. And so you can take that energy, whether it be fear or anger or sadness, and you can flip it. And you can flip it to the energy of empowerment, the energy of I'm in charge of what I am eating, and I choose not to be a victim. I choose not to be told by the biotechnology companies or their Washington branch, the FDA, what I am supposed to eat. I can choose for myself. All right, let's begin and talk about a little history of I'll tell you about a different history than Craig described. And this is the history of the genetically modified food and safety issues. I'll start in 1989. Individuals started going to doctors with all sorts of...
Hello.
Hi, Johnny. You with us?
John,
yes, I am.
Oh, we weren't sure whether you were going to be on or not.
Sorry, I got in very late from work. It was almost a no-show tonight here, but I made us just a little bit on the line. Sorry about the delay.
Oh, that's all right. We're glad you're with us. We were just playing something on genetically modified food. So what do you have for us tonight?
Well, I really don't want to overlap on what you guys might have already talked about. I'm taking it you probably have discussed the affairs in Japan with the nuclear... The nukes basically melting down over there.
Yeah, we did. We talked. We read a couple of articles on that. Greg Palast had a very good article on the plants and on who's behind them and on how it's going to be brought to our country. The same kind of faulty kind of technology and plants. So we have to be very careful.
Exactly. Yes. There's a lot of. A lot of the people in Japan don't trust their own government, apparently, over there to get any truth about what's happening.
Right. And they, according to the article that Greg Palast wrote, whistleblowing is something that doesn't happen in Japan. People don't do that. They don't say when there's something faulty or there's something wrong. Actually, the company behind those plants is Toshiba. And when Obama... tried to push these new nuclear plants in the Gulf off of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
He said it was the Westinghouse company. Well, really, it's Toshiba that bought the Westinghouse brand. It's not an American company at all.
Yeah, one of the plants was designed by GE. I did hear that report.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, actually, all of them were designed by GE. But...
All of them may have been then, yeah. I couldn't confirm if all of them were, but certainly one was, whether it was the Hamaoka plant or the Fukushima, I'm not sure, but it's one or the other, or perhaps both. And all I know is I think there's, 17 nuclear plants are over there, I think, is altogether. I think it was I think it's in 2003. There was 17 nuclear plants that were temporarily shut down for falsifying safety inspection reports. And it was learned that the coolant water data at two plants were falsified in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's been critics that have been expressing deep concern about the safety of many of Japan's nuclear facilities, you know, going right back to the 70s and the 80s. And
wow.
The Fukushima plant has long been on the critics' radar, but so has the, like I said, the Hamaoka plant, and that's 100 miles southwest of Tokyo, and it's built on an active fault line, which is incredible. And in fact, it's not the only place that has nuclear plants built on very dangerous places. Even in Austin, Texas, there's lots of nuclear plants in Texas, but right in the Austin area, there is known underground volcanoes. Yeah, they're you know, they're way below ground, but they're there, just like what's in Yellowstone. There's certainly a volcanic activity could erupt at any time. To go and build nuclear plants in these areas, we're about to find out what's going to happen across the world. I mean, people in California are going to have to start taking the potassium iodide tablets very shortly if this wave of nuclear fallout gets into the jet stream and the winds take it towards the west coast of the United States. And we're already seeing reports, I think, on the headlines on Yahoo there or Google.
Yeah.
It's popped up on the computer, breaking news. So the health food stores in Japan are sold out of the stuff. I've had it around here for a long time. It's probably expired. I'll have to check the packets. It's foil-wrapped and possibly okay. But don't want to scare people, but, you know, okay, we're on the East Coast. Most of the people, I imagine, listening to this, I don't know that for sure. It's just a guess somehow. I guess with the internet, it could be anywhere. However, the possibility is there that, you know, if they get this meltdown of another plant, this is worse than Chernobyl. You know,
they said it is because in Chernobyl there was a huge blast that sent all of the radioactivity into the ionosphere, whereas with these plants, the contamination is at ground level.
Right, right.
And that's extremely bad for human life and plant life and animal life.
Mm-hmm.
And Chernobyl, they didn't have any, they didn't have casings over the reactors either. Whereas these at least have casings, you know, they have exterior retaining walls, you know. But Chernobyl was just a complete and utter, you know, crazy.
Yeah, but this is
going to
be
totally total.
But you didn't listen to what they said, though. They said that the scientists who came on said that
it was worse. Yeah, no,
is worse.
I heard that. And
what have you read, John?
It's going to be much worse for the people.
Oh, there's just so many articles I could bring up on this. I mean, the thing is, people, I'm sure, have, you know, got their own thoughts on it. But I just know that the nuclear plants, you know, they use this radioactive material to heat and generate electricity. Now, huge amounts are needed to prevent overheating of these plants. So the vast amounts of coolant are required, up to like 1 million gallons a minute.
Yeah.
Of water is required. And without that, meltdowns are going to occur because in less than a minute, temperatures can reach 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. That's hot enough to burn through the
bottom of
your plant.
They're putting in water, which is highly salty, which will
corrode everything.
It renders the facility useless, pretty much, once you do that.
They're going to have to close all those places down.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. But can you really ever close a nuclear plant down? I mean, the one in Chernobyl is cemented in. There may be still some active core material there.
Oh, yeah, no, you can't. They tried to do that in Waterford. With the millstone one, and they couldn't do it. Everything is now retained on site. Okay, all the spent fuel rods and everything are on site because they don't have anywhere to get rid of them.
So that's why I'm so against them building anymore.
Sure.
And Obama, you know, he's just such a tool of big business.
They keep marching on just to the same thing, business as usual.
Yeah, have the same agenda, and Lieberwurm had the nerve to come on and say, well, we'll just see what happens, but there's no point in canceling these.
Yeah, Switzerland and Germany, two very advanced nations technologically, have stopped everything nuclear power plant-wise. It's a complete shutdown.
Oh, really? They don't use them at all anymore?
Well, no further use of their any building that's in progress is being halted.
That's very smart. I hope they continue with that.
Right. I think that was a smart move. Obviously, there are great earth fluctuations occurring and possibly about to occur. Whether this is to do with the Mayan calendar, you know, the pole shift, or the pole shift is being deliberately altered through the electromagnetic HARP facility that's causing a lot of the weather problems, the chemtrailing, all that's interconnected. But either way, we're after seeing tremendous amounts of disruption across the planet in the last 5 years. It seems like every month there's something, like whether it's earthquakes down in Chile, down in New Zealand, you know, the one that was down in Arkansas, there was a small earthquake down there. There just seems to be every day there's something. So, you know what I'm saying? The overall picture, it looks pretty bleak for any of these nuclear plants. It would be advisable, in my opinion, to temporarily shut them all down. And that might take months or years to even shut them down.
Well, we're surrounded by them here. We have nuclear plants on the coast.
Yeah, that's water bridge, yep.
Not too far from us in north of New York City.
Indian Point, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's plenty of them. And believe me, if anything happens, you'd be right in the line of fire for radioactive material. If you're a couple hundred miles away from it in any direction, there's really, unless you've got an airplane.
Yeah, we have them all around us, John. You know, the reason they said that we should have nuclear plants is that it would keep the cost of energy down. We pay the highest for our electricity in the country here in Connecticut.
Right, and of course the people who are promoting global warming, the alleged global warming, I should say, which has been proved to be the hoax, the biggest hoax of the century. There's a big, it's a big taxation scheme, and the nuclear energy people are making a packet on it because it's supposedly clean energy for the environment. Well, it's not so clean now.
No.
All in one shot. If we had all the worst CO2 man ever created from the beginning of time released all in one go, it would not be as harmful as this radiation leak.
Yeah, which they ignore.
But these radiation symptoms can last for like billions of years. You know, you'll have deformities of the DNA. This goes into second generation. You have babies born 50 years from now with no legs or no heads or something because of what people are inhaling today and taking into their bodies.
And this is better than
CO2. I don't understand it.
But the Japanese have already gone through that in during the Second World War
II.
And they had 30 years or more of horrible
radiation
problems that affected their population for almost 30 years or 40 years afterwards.
It's still probably continuing.
It's still continuing, yeah. They don't talk about it, but there were. I can remember reports not 10 years ago, maybe or less, about the reactions that they were still having, radiation problems from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, those areas. But you know the thing that bothers me most, though, Johnny, is that I read an article today that this radioactive cloud could wind up here in the United States.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Yeah, the winds are heading. I think there may be something right on the Yahoo headlines about that. I certainly believe that the West Coast within a week will be probably getting warned to take the potassium iodide tablets.
It'll be on the West Coast, I would think more so, but how far inland it'll go, I don't know.
Well,
from the Pacific Shore.
My guess is you'll never know the truth. None of us ever will. If it's the same people are going to tell us the truth that told us the truth about 9/11 events, which, I mean, it's got more holes in it than Swiss cheese. What happened in Oklahoma City, you know, supposedly one truck bomb when, you know, they found others in the buildings. But the main story is it was just Timothy McVeigh. I mean, when you look, if you've seen the videos on what really happened in Oklahoma City, the Waco incident, you know, after any deep investigation, you can find out that the powers that be just lied. They couldn't care less about us. They just tell us anything they can just to pacify us. Go back to sleep. You're okay. So what if you get radiation poisoning? They're just as happy to see us die off like a bunch of ants anyway because of their policies for depopulation.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
No, it's sad to say that. It might sound negative, but unfortunately, having read all of the papers they've put out, you know, everything from the Club of Rome right up to, you know, the Rockefellers, Global 2000, Agenda 21, you've spoken about that many times, the United Nations policy documents for how the future is going to be. This has to be somewhat useful. So the only bad thing is, the land will be useless to everybody eventually as well. Biological is what they like better. It kills the population.
As much as I see that, I don't see. Maybe the Gulf oil spill was a rigged deal, but I don't know about the. This is too much to think that anybody other than corruption had a hand in it.
I'm not saying that this was sort of there's any conspiratorial. I think this was just a natural event. This one, I think, has caught them off guard. But at the same time, it does in a way play into their sort of thought process, even though it's one that's backfired on them a little bit. It's a little more than they bargained for this time to have this happen.
Really, I feel so sorry for the people who are there who can't leave and have no place to go.
It really is extremely sad. And, you know, the Japanese people, you know, have done a great job in their economy, worked like slaves, I suppose, for the last 50 years. Of course, their economy, people don't realize, it has been in a lot of trouble. They went into a recession in the mid-80s, never really came out of it. At least that's the story we're told. You know, economically, we see, you know, Toyota cars being shipped all over the world and every other kind of car from Japan. But I don't think the wealth has trickled down to the people on the street. They're pretty they're not wealthy people like the Americans are. The vast majority of Americans, what they are, used to be. We were already trickling down to the lower level as well.
Yeah, with the cost of fuel oil going up, the cost of food going up,
exactly,
and wages going down at the same time, it's going to be very difficult for ordinary Americans to make it.
It's getting really, really. It's not possible actually to make it. You know, unless you're very lucky. There is a luck factor. I've always said involved in everything. Maybe if you're lucky enough to get the good education. And get become a doctor or something, but you know, not everybody can get the money to go to college, be a doctor. But I'm off subject here. But the poor Japanese people are definitely, after seeing what happened in World War II with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that was, you know, nuclear, and now this is a reminder. After all of the great achievements of, you know, motorbike building, cars, musical instruments, all of the stuff they've built. They pretty much may have to abandon the land that they once lived on.
Yeah, I'm wondering that, if they're going to have to do that.
How far this will be.
And how pervasive the contamination is in their country.
Well, I mean, like I said, to find this knowledge, I don't think you're going to find it on CNN. They're not going to realistically tell them you can't live here anymore. They're just going to say, oh, it's fine. But the guys who will be testing them, if you look at them, they'll all have the radioactive suits and the Geiger counters.
Yeah.
And they measure them. Oh, you're fine, you know.
And they won't. They probably won't let them leave if they're contaminated.
Exactly.
They won't be able to leave.
No. And again, if the food shortages continue over there, Tokyo City is almost without food.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you can go and see some live footage. I don't know. too many people understand Japanese, but it is all in Japanese. You can make out kind of what's happening at the news conferences just by expressions and some of the photos that come on the background. It's at live broadcast Tokyo.com. And it's just like watching CNN over in Japan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so you'll see live broadcast Tokyo.com.
Is it very tragic, John?
Yeah, some of the right now it's mostly conferences. But up to the last 5 days, they were the on the ground video footage was very graphic, very sad. It was sort of it almost looked like some of the scenes at when Hurricane Katrina had you know taken apart New Orleans.
Yeah.
Those type of scenes, to say the least. You know, it was pretty bad.
So how has the chemtrailing been this past week up here in the northern part of Connecticut?
We haven't had much chemtrail except for this morning. We haven't had much sunlight, so that's why we haven't had any clear blue sky for them to spray anything into. But this morning at about 11:30, the sun was beginning to break through, and I was on a job site out in Watertown, Connecticut, and I just happened to look out the window and there was a number of them spraying, again, like I said, right across the sun is where you generally see it, where the radiant heat of the sun appears to expand the chemical that's sprayed from the back of these military jets. And it did form a synthetic cloud cover and blocked out the sun. And we've had a overcast day probably 2 hours after that. And then I think Thursday it's supposed to rain. So, yeah, it always seems to be they spray 2 days before the rain. I don't know how it all works, but I know I've seen it enough times that this is what's going on. They're altering the weather deliberately. There's no question about that. Actually, speaking of which, we have a couple of minutes. There is an article here I found here, and it was from the Mail Online. Have scientists discovered how to create downpours in the desert? This is from, like I said, the Mail Online. For centuries, people living in the Middle East have dreamed of turning the sandy desert into land fit for growing crops with fresh water on top. Now, that holy grail is a step closer after scientists employed by the ruler of Abu Dhabi claim to have generated a series of downpours. 50 rainstorms were created last year in the state's eastern Al Ain region using technology designed to control the weather. Most of the storms were at the height of the summer in July and in August, when there is no rain at all. People living in Abu Dhabi were baffled by the rainfall, which sometimes turned into hail and included gales and lightning. And that's from the January 3rd, 2011 Mail Online. So another of the weird phenomena people will see around here. Well, you probably have your thunder snow or thunder lightning. I'm 52 years old, have no recollection of ever seeing that when I was younger. Maybe in the summer, playing outside, running in out of the lightning after, you know, it was a 90-degree day and then a bit of cold air came in. But in the winter when it was snowing, lightning, lighting up the sky like an arc welder, never.
Have you seen that, John?
Oh, absolutely. I've seen it over in Ireland and I've seen it over here. It's weird. They are messing around with the ionosphere of our atmosphere all around the Earth, the electrojet that's all around there. They're using it from weaponizing the weather and tampering with it for weather, you know, creating storms where they can. It can be used for good, but it can also be used for bad. But tampering with it in any way whatsoever can cause havoc with the world's weather patterns.
Well, I find it unusual that we had so much rain and so much snow.
Oh, absolutely. It's all completely unnatural is what it is. They have tapped into where God only once played a part, for those who believe in God. I mean, there was God may be one who controls the weather in the minds of some, but nowadays he has a whole lot of help with this facility up in Alaska called the HARP, and we've talked about that many times, High Active Auroral Research Project.
Let me just interrupt here for a minute because we've got 25 seconds.
Oh, okay.
I just want to let everybody know, thank you for joining us tonight. And if you want to listen to the next 5 minutes or so, go to 646-915-9505, and you can hear the rest of it. 646-915-9505. All right, and otherwise, thank you so much for joining us, and you can pick up the rest of this on the in the archives. All right, Johnny, we just lost our stream, so.
Oh, okay. Well, I can continue on a little while, or?
Well, actually, not that long, but, you know.
Okay, well, I mean, I was just going over some of the finer points of what can be done with the weather. Some people still don't believe that weather can be altered by man, but there's no question. It's just, if you think that, it's the same as sort of believing the Earth is still flat. The technology is so advanced that it's beyond your imagination. In fact, the weather is easier to control than probably creating microchips, you know what I mean, by putting metallic particulates into the atmosphere,
yeah.
Using frequencies, ELF frequencies. All they have to do is create vibrations and move the cloud patterns around. It really is very, very simple.
So what are you doing for St. Paddy's Day there, Johnny?
Well, that's a good question. At this point, it's on a rather bad day for me to go out and have a few drinks at nighttime because I've got to work the next day, and well, one thing or another, we're pretty busy. But maybe next Saturday I'll celebrate it instead. Won't be on the 17th.
On Sunday, right?
Yes, possibly Saturday or Sunday. I'll have to. It'll be a late.
You're going to join us on Sunday on the green, right?
Oh, sorry. Yes, I wasn't thinking about that. Yes, I will absolutely.
Yeah, Sunday on the green.
We're all going to meet there.
And the notice that I got was that there's going to be a reception afterwards.
Oh, there is. Okay.
Yeah, but they haven't. To be determined. That's what
to
I.
To be determined. Guess. Okay, that's very nice. We'll talk about it when we all get there.
Yeah, I guess we'll find out about it when we get there. But I'm going to say good night. It was really nice to talk with you, and I'm so glad you were able to be on, John. We thought at first that maybe you wouldn't, but you had to work late. Sorry about that.
I'm a little unprepared tonight. I'm sorry about that. I'm a little all over the place in what we were talking about. But I'm glad to get on and just make some kind of appearance, and I'll try and be a little more organized next week with my thoughts.
Oh, that'll
and,
be good.
Always good to be back on the LACO show.
We're always glad to have you, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thank you very much, and good night to everybody.
Okay, good night, Johnny.
And thanks for joining us, folks. Join us again tomorrow night and Thursday night and Friday night with George Dixon.
Yeah.
So good night until tomorrow.
Have a good night.